Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel. They call me Ben. We're joined with our guest super producer, Max the Freight Train Williams. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. That makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. As you are listening to this, on the day this podcast publishes, it is an infamous anniversary in the United States. 60 years ago, the president of the U.S., John Fitzgerald Kennedy, was assassinated November 22nd, 1963, riding in a presidential motorcade in Dallas, Texas. The tragedy of this day fundamentally altered the course of American and indeed global history. Decades later, the world entire still has questions about what led to this murder and how it occurred. We've asked these questions previously in Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, but tonight, we are immensely fortunate to be joined with the legendary director, the actor, the activist, the writer, now podcaster, Rob Reiner, creator and co-host of Who Killed JFK. Thank you for joining us, Rob. It is a profound honor.
Oh, thank you, Ben. That's so sweet of you. Thanks for having me.
Can I just get my fanboy thing out of the way really quick? But this is Spinal Tap is my favorite movie of all time, and I force everyone in my life to watch it while I tear up because it's so moving and hilarious, and it's just everything I love about rock and roll. It's so good, and I hear you're working on a new one.
It'll make you feel good that we're now engaged in filming a sequel. We're going to do it. It's the first time in 40 years. We came up with an idea, and the four of us are going to get out there and make a sequel to Spinal Tap.
Take it to 11.
The three of us are musicians, and we've got video degrees and everything. So we just are right in that exact place where this is Spinal Tap just is like I don't know. It's a mecca of some
sort. It looms
sort.
Large. And I just wrapped up a podcast documentary about the Stones in 72, and I had a lot of tape I was working with from them from those days, and I realized I think you were doing their voices. I think the Spinal Tap guys are the Stones circa 72 with their soft-spoken little British lilts. Something to it. Maybe I'm wrong, but
well,
I couldn't
know.
Get
you
Spinal
know,
Tap out of my
head.
As
we say in the film, there's a fine line between stupid and clever. And so we try to hit that line.
And isn't that also in some ways part of the discourse that has surrounded the allegations of conspiracy in the JFK assassination? You know,
good segue.
Ooh, look at that segue. Wow. I gotta put a neck brace on and call my insurance agent because
he's got a point though, Rob. Stupid and clever. That's something that we see a lot with conspiracy stuff because
yeah, that's true.
Maybe clever is a bit of a misnomer, but it's all about like how close are there facts involved? Is there some logical reasoning behind it, or are people just passing the time?
Right, right. No, you're exactly right because the words conspiracy theory have gotten a weird take now because everybody, who's aspiring to, QAnon or disinformation or they're going on wacky websites and things. Anybody who talks about conspiracy theory has got a tinfoil hat and, is running around, spotting UFOs all over the place. But there are actual conspiracies that actually happen. And this is one of them. And the podcast that we do, Who Killed JFK, that I do with Soledad O'Brien, is the deepest dive and the most comprehensive look at that conspiracy and how it happened. As we say in the podcast, it's the greatest murder mystery in the history of America. Mm-hmm. Nothing like it has ever happened before. And the America was traumatized. There was a concentrated trauma put at the heart of America at that point, and people who were alive at the time will never get over it. It was a collective trauma that gripped the entire country, and we're still feeling the effects of it today.
And that note about never getting over it, there's something poetic with the beginning of episode one. I think maybe we also, before we start with the first episode of Who Killed JFK, let's travel back, if it's all right, to your experience, to the moment, the day of the assassination. Again, it's November 22nd, 1963, just a few days before Thanksgiving. You are, I believe, 16 years old.
Right.
And, could you paint the picture for us and for our right. listeners of that experience?
Yes. I mean, anybody who was alive at that time and was aware knows exactly where they were when they heard that news. You can talk to anybody. They'll tell you exactly where they were and what was happening. I was 16, as you said. I was in high school. I was in my physics class. And I'll never forget, a student walked in, whispered into the teacher's ear, and he turned to us and he said, "I have some terrible news." And he relayed to us what had happened to the president. And we were all just stunned and shocked. We were sent home from school. Everybody was sent home. And we turned on our televisions and we watched nonstop a television on the reports up until, and I was one of the people who watched the person who was accused of killing President Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald. I watched him get assassinated on live television. I mean, it actually happened. I watched this man. We found out his name was Jack Ruby, who was a local nightclub owner of a place called the Carousel Nightclub. He went into the Dallas police station, drew a gun, and stood right in front of Lee Harvey Oswald and shot him to death. And for many of us, that was the moment at which we said, "What the heck is going on here? The man who has supposedly killed the president is now being murdered himself. Why is that happening? Who's doing this? Who's behind all this?"
You're talking to three guys who were born in the 80s. So You know, when we first encounter this, we get to an age where, you know, our parents decide we can learn about the JFK assassination, or our schools decide we are allowed to learn about it. We have all of this information already built in, right? But in going back and listening to Who Killed JFK, this podcast, we're being presented with this information as it was happening, right? So we get that experience that you're sharing with us now, Rob. And one of the things you mentioned early on is how comedians like Mort Saul and Dick Gregory were kind of, they were using their material as a way for America to begin to process this information, right?
Yes, yes. And what's interesting about that is these guys were both brilliant social and political satirists. These were the most incisive, well-observed type people who looked at American life and observed it in the most intelligent and fine way. And when they diverged from their normal routines, in the case of Mort Saul, I was 19 when I watched him go in. I was opening for at the Hungry Eye for a singer named Carmen McRae. She was a great jazz singer. And when I would finish my set with my partner, Larry Bishop, we'd go into this smaller room where Mort Saul was not doing his normal routine. He was only talking about the Kennedy assassination, and the Warren Commission report on the assassination had come out, and he was attacking it. He was saying it's full of lies. It doesn't make any sense. And people like Dick Gregory, who went on Geraldo Rivera's show, and for the first time they exposed the Zapruder film, which was the only film that really captures the assassination by a guy named Abraham Zapruder, who was a local dressmaker. Those people, those two comedians, really started the conversation moving forward. People started getting engaged, and those people could draw your attention. They were great speakers. They were great, incisive commentators on the times. When I saw Mort Saul, I started really getting into it. I read a book called Rush to Judgment by a writer named Mark Lane, and he completely disbanded the Warren Commission and pointed out the inconsistencies, the things that were left out, the lies. And you started getting into realizing that this was not only a cover-up by the government of what had happened, but it uncovered, as you track it over the years, this conspiracy that American forces got together to kill an American president in broad daylight on an American street. And the more you look into it, the more disturbing it is. And, you know, I was saying that, you know, you look at something like this, and it's 60 years has gone by, and unless you're following it closely, there are revelations that come out in drips and drabs. And when they come out, unless you're following it all, you don't know what that has to do with anything else. So this podcast, what it does is it takes 60 years of revelations, puts it all in one place, and hopefully makes it understandable to people and complete, you know, fills in the puzzle of what actually happened on that day.
Yeah. And this is something that I think is key, the contextualization. We were talking a little bit off air, Rob, people who are somewhat familiar with the JFK assassination and the ins and outs of it may be surprised to learn that documents pertaining to it were classified until quite recently, and new information begins to emerge. Who Killed JFK does a phenomenal job of connecting some of these puzzle pieces. And already you've mentioned some very bright points about this that remain controversial, especially the Warren Commission, which I think you do a supreme and scrupulous job of pointing out some possible conflicts of interest.
Possible.
Guys, I'm throwing to Rob.
Here's what's interesting about this. There were huge conflicts of interest. First of all, there's still almost 5,000 documents that have not been released to the public. And, you know, we may never see those documents. But the conflict of interest that you're talking about And there were two investigations. People have to understand there are two official government investigations of the assassination of JFK. The first was the Warren Commission, which came out in 1964. And the second one was done by a group called the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And that was, came out in the mid-70s. It came out to actually the report came out in the late 70s. Both of those investigations were compromised. And the way in which that happened is in the first investigation, the Warren Commission, Lyndon Johnson was very concerned about things getting out that might implicate the Russians or the Cubans in a way that might ultimately cause a nuclear war. And he wanted to avoid that. He didn't want any information to come into the investigation that would do anything but point to Lee Harvey Oswald as a lone gunman. So what he did is they put together this commission headed up by Chief Justice Earl Warren, but his name was mostly titular in this. They put in charge of the gatekeeper sense of all information coming from the CIA into the hands of a man named Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles was the first civilian head of the CIA in the 1940s. Now, Alan Dulles was one of the architects of the Bay of Pigs invasion. The Bay of Pigs invasion was an attempt by the CIA to train Cuban exiles to go into Cuba and overthrow Castro, who had overthrown Batista just a few years prior. Now, Alan Dulles had this plan with the CIA working with these Cuban exiles. They went into the Bay of, they went into Cuba and they did invade. And they thought that Kennedy would offer air support, that once the troops got in there, they would send American planes and they would take back Cuba. Kennedy told them before the, and by the way, Kennedy inherited this plan from Eisenhower and Nixon. He was only in office for 2 or 3 months when they did this. He told them ahead of time, I will not send American airplanes because I don't want the United States footprint. I don't want any fingerprints on to be tracked back to the United States. He told them that, and Dulles said, there's no way, don't worry about it. Once we get in there, he's going to see this, and he's going to want to send those airplanes. He never did, and what happened was all the Cuban exes, they were slaughtered on the beaches of Cuba, and it was a complete and utter disaster. Months later, Kennedy fires Alan Dulles and is known to have said, I want to take the CIA and break it up into 1,000 pieces. He was furious at the CIA because they were doing these covert activities without presidential approvals. I mean, they were doing them separately and then reporting back to the president. So he wanted to get rid of it. Johnson puts Alan Dulles in charge of any information coming from the CIA into the Warren Commission. And, obviously nothing got in. We didn't know about the CIA's connection to the mafia. We didn't know about the CIA's extrajudicial killings of heads of state, which they did many of. We didn't know about a lot of the involvement with the Cubans in Cuba. We didn't know any of this stuff. So Alan Dulles is compromising that. Now, the big revelation, the big revelation was in the second investigation. That was for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And we bring this up in the podcast as well. And this didn't come out until years after the investigation. But the man put in charge of being the liaison between the House investigation and the CIA was a man named George Joannides. You've never heard of his name. You don't know who he is. But what I'll tell you is George Joannides was a former CIA agent, and he was the head of a counterintelligence program that developed assets, one of which was Lee Harvey Oswald. So the guy who was the gatekeeper again to the CIA was the very guy who they wanted to, who they should have questioned. We interviewed Robert Blakey, who was the counsel to the House Select Committee. He had no idea that this is what Joe Anides did. And when he found out many years later, he was furious. He said, if I had known then what I knew now, I would have put Joe Anides on the stand. He was the answer to many of our questions of how the CIA was involved in the assassination. So, you know, there you have two big pieces of information. They're separated by many, many years, and we try to put it all together in one place.
And there's also the question a lot of our fellow listeners will be asking, which is there such thing as a former CIA agent? It makes
no.
you think.
No, right? No, there's no such thing. I mean, a CIA agent, you may not be active in the way you were when you were being paid by the agency, but you have security clearance and you have it for your life. And you know, it was an interesting thing recently with a Trump, I think, tried to strip John Brennan of his security clearance because he didn't like what John Brennan was saying about him and about his, his involvement in January 6th. So, yes, you're always connected once you're there.
But even without the clearances, I mean, the relationships, these lifelong relationships and contacts that you can leverage even minus the security clearances.
Correct.
I mean, I think that stuff is money in the bank. I mean,
that's true.
Power.
Just a real quick insert here for anybody that wants to go deep down the rabbit hole. I'm looking at a declassified document here that describes Mr. Ioannidis' work from December 1962 to April 1964, and it describes him as the case officer for the Cuban exile group Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil,
which
is known as DRE.
Yeah, it's a student-directed anti-Castro group.
Mm-hmm. And there's something else too, and I know people are yelling at their phones right now or however you listen to shows. The House Select Committee, you have this terrifying observation, Rob, in Who Killed JFK, where you say, look, these are two fundamentally flawed investigations and they reach two very different conclusions. And one thing that I think stands out for people who were born after the assassination is to read the conclusions of the House Select Committee and see that they have dropped the C word. They have said the assassination seemed to be the result of I believe the quote is probable conspiracy. But
yes.
Then.
Yes. I mean, the Warren Commission basically said that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman, did it all by himself. The House Select Committee said it was probably a conspiracy based on all the investigation they had done. But they didn't say who was involved in the conspiracy. They never could get that far because of this guy, George Ioannidis. They didn't name the mob. They didn't name the CIA. They didn't talk about the Cuban exiles. They just said, based on the information they had, it was probably a conspiracy. So you have two diametrically opposed conclusions. And those are the two government records now.
And Warren Commission is 1964, so right. Very soon after the assassination. And the House Select Committee isn't until 1976. So just imagine, like, again, already we've got a decade separating these two things. And
right.
And you wonder why Americans in general, you're talking about drips and drabs of information coming out. From the very beginning, it's like we're getting little bits and pieces.
Right, right.
And I swear it feels like it's designed that way.
Yeah, but, well, yeah. I don't know design, but if you think about, you mentioned Dick Gregory, the House Select Committee was born out of an investigation by Idaho Senator Frank Church. They had a committee there set up in the Senate, and that was based on information that was coming out that the CIA was doing all kinds of things that they were not aware of, and it came out as a revelation during that they were doing these extrajudicial killings, that other things were going on. And then Dick Gregory went on the Geraldo show, and they showed the Zapruder film for the first time. Now, the Zapruder film was, the Warren Commission saw it. The public had not seen it. Nobody
just
knew
anything. Just still photographs, right?
Just some still photographs, but we didn't have a context, and we didn't see it. When that came out, and the church committee started revealing what they knew, that gave birth to the House Select Committee. And that was, like you say, well over 10 years after the Warren Commission came out. So now you all of a sudden you have another flashpoint. Now, when Oliver Stone made his film, JFK, in 1992 or 91, I believe it was, that also triggered the JFK Records Act and the creation of the Assassination Records Review Board, which was another investigation. So these things are separated by many, many years. And during each of these investigations, more and more and more information came out. So, like I say, it's very tough to follow. And unless you're tracking all this stuff when it comes out, You wouldn't know how to put those pieces together. That's what we try to do in this podcast.
And you do it.
Yeah, I would say accomplished so far. And folks, full disclosure here, we are in media res. We are listening along with you all. We do not know how the story concludes yet. I do want to throw one thing here that's an interesting note, Rob, that I...
Before you put a pin in it, I want to hear the interesting note. But by the end of it, by the 10th episode, you will hear what we believe happened that day. And we will name the shooters that we believe were shooting. And we will name the positions that we believe those shooters were in. So I'm just...
That's pretty next level, Rob.
Will you come back on the show?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay.
So it'll be later than this early in the morning,
yes,
we promise.
Yes, agreed. So there's something interesting in speaking of contextualization. There is a deep temptation often that pulls us away from objectivity when we start connecting dots, right? Because humans identify patterns. And I noticed that of the seven official members of the Warren Commission, one died disappeared under extremely mysterious circumstances before the House Select Committee and the Church Committee got their crack at this. And that would be Hale Boggs,
who
disappeared over the hinterlands of Alaska, basically.
There was a plane crash. That, we can't say for sure what happened there. We don't know. And we're not going to conjecture over this. It happened, but there are a lot of mysterious deaths that occurred right after the Warren Commission came out. There was a very famous woman who was married to a CIA agent. Her name was Mary Meyer, and her sister was having an affair with Jack Kennedy, and she died. And this is one of the reasons I wanted Soledad O'Brien to do this with me, because she did a podcast about this called Murder on the Towpath, in which this woman was assassinated walking in Georgetown. And the day that she was killed, James Angleton, who was the head of counterintelligence for the CIA, along with Ben Bradley, who was editor of the Washington Post, they arrived at Mary Meyer's art studio and confiscated a diary that she kept. So there's that. And, Dorothy Kilgallen, who was killed shortly after attending the Jack Ruby trial and was the only one to have actual interviews with Jack Ruby. She was killed. And there was a number of people. We did a study, and there were about, I think, 18 critical key witnesses who died of either a heart attack or suicide or accident or jump out of a window, something. Within 2 years of the assassination, and they ran some numbers on it, and it's like 700 trillion, I mean, some crazy number, the odds of all of those people dying in that way. But, you know, we don't get into any of that stuff because we can't prove why these people died. I mean, and so what we've tried to do in the podcast is just stick with what we know. These are things we know. And then, you know, we do our best guess as to put together, based on everything we know, what actually happened.
And we'll pause here for a word from our sponsor before we return and ask Rob Reiner who killed JFK.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi, guys. Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
And we have returned.
You know, we talked a little bit off mic before we started rolling just about this event being sort of the beginning of this massive polarization of the American people. Right. And it being, you described it as sort of an end of innocence. And I think, and Ben, you wrote in the outline here, this really was a moment that you could trace back to when distrust in our government really kind of began as much more of a mainstream thing. Yeah. Rob, can you kind of cobble all those ideas together into sort of your thoughts on what that end of innocence means and
well,
why?
I mean, like, we, you know, we, after the Second World War, we were the heroes. We were the good guys, and we couldn't do nothing wrong. I mean, we had prosperity, and people, the GI Bill, and people were living in, the suburbs, and they were, things were doing, better for a lot of people, not for black people, but for a lot of Americans. And then you have this moment happen in 1963 where it's like, your father was taken. I mean, the leader of the country was just killed like that. And we knew at the time, which came out, that Kennedy was trying to forge a path to peace. He gave a very famous speech at American University where he talked about, we cannot go down this road of nuclear Holocaust. We have to find a way to forge a path to peace. Well, in the context of that, he wrote a memo, which is on file, that he was going to call for the removal of 1,000 troops out of Vietnam that year and the removal of all military out of Vietnam by the end of 1965. Now, we don't know, would he have done that? Would he not have done that? What we do know is that he wrote the memo. And certainly the hardliners in the CIA and the military knew that. And they were worried that that was going to happen. So what happens? Kennedy gets assassinated. Johnson becomes president. And the next thing you know, we're stepping up the war in Vietnam. And that, to me, was the beginning of a huge divide in America.
Who does that benefit, though, staying in Vietnam? I think I understand. But just from your perspective, the hardliners, as you mentioned, who is benefiting from us maintaining a presence in Vietnam when it was such a disastrous conflict?
Well, first of all, ideologically, the hardliners are thinking, and that was certainly the thoughts of the day, there was a better dead than red. They believed that there was this domino theory, and that if one country went fell communist, that there would be a domino theory and the rest of the world would go communist. They were actually afraid that the world was going to turn into a communistic world. So ideologically, that's what they thought. Now, on a purely economic standpoint, you make money. You go to war, and in the military-industrial complex, which, by the way, Eisenhower warned us, beware of the military-industrial complex. They want to be able to do that because it's good business. So those two things are happening there. And for young people, they're being sent off to war, to die in a war that they don't believe is just, they don't believe is legal. And if you remember, people who want to study their history, there was a thing called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which was all about the fact that we were told that our ship was fired on in Vietnam. This Tonkin ship was fired on. And so, in the Gulf of Tonkin. And that was the pretext for why we went to war in Vietnam. So you had a lot of distrust going on, and the country started to divide. There were protests all over the country, and we divided as a nation. And I believe that it was the beginning of the divide that you see now. This country couldn't be more divided than they are now. And I would point back to what happened in going into Vietnam, that was the beginning of that divide.
Well, there's so many things to talk about here that branch from that. But we learn in your podcast that JFK was maintaining, maybe off the books, we would say, contact with Soviet officials, like the highest Soviet officials and Cuban officials, and attempting to smooth things out directly rather than through the mechanisms that would normally you'd need to go through to have those conversations.
Called back channeling. He was back channeling with Khrushchev. He was back channeling with Castro, directly with Khrushchev and Castro, to make sure that, and this is on the heels of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which happened a year after the Bay of Pigs. The Cuban Missile Crisis, as people know, or maybe they're learning for the first time, was we were on the brink of a nuclear war. And those of us who were alive at the time will never, ever forget it. We found out that there were nuclear weapons in Cuba that were put there by the Russians 90 miles away from America, and that could reach Washington in 20 minutes. So we were doing drills in school. Now they have active shooter drills. In my time, they had a duck and cover drill.
Duck and cover.
Yeah, that you'd under the desk.
You'd get under a desk in case of a nuclear. Now, I used to make a joke about it, which is, you know, it was a known fact that the material that they made school desks out of could actually repel a nuclear bomb. But it's, of course, it's ridiculous.
It's optics, though, right? It's this idea of this illusion of safety, you know?
Yeah, that we better, you know, keep ourselves safe. So we were all believing that we were a minute away from a nuclear holocaust. And that was the basis upon, you know, which we lived. So he started to back channel. He said, you know, we can't let this happen. What can we do? He settled the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy did. He made a deal with Khrushchev. We had missiles in Turkey. He said to Khrushchev, we'll take those missiles out of Turkey if you take these missiles out of Cuba, which happened. But then he said, from there on, we got to make sure that nothing like this happens again, because we're going to blow up the whole world if we do this. And so he started back channeling to Castro, to Khrushchev, and the CIA was well aware of that. They became well aware of that, and that added to their distrust of Kennedy in terms of his fight against communism.
And also, there seems to be this, it was a thing that the American public was largely unaware of, but there was internal dissent escalating into chaos at the same time there was this move for de-escalation of
during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the hardliners in both the CIA and the military were pushing Kennedy like crazy. Make a strike, take them out, take those missiles out, go after them. And they were very upset with him when he chose this other path. It was contentious. There was a lot of screaming, yelling going on in the White. It's 13 days, very famous time, 13 days where we all lived on the edge of, are we going to be blown up?
Do you feel, Rob, that there was a somewhat of a like lack of respect amid the unelected power structures of U.S. governance? Because from what we've been reading, it seems as though when Kennedy enters office, you know, the CIA still high off the OSS World War II actions, they're kind of coming in with this attitude that, yes, you will be a figurehead and you will do what we, the adults, say.
Not only that, but Kennedy campaigned in 1960 as a anti-communist, strong against communism. There was a big debate, with Nixon. It was on television. I think it was one of the first televised debates. And he had to show that he had real bona fides in fighting communism. He ran as a anti-communist, strong-willed guy who would stand, you know, in his inaugural address, we'll stand up to any foe, we'll fight anybody to do this. And he knew in order to win, he had to show his strength against communism. But as the realities presented himself, he realizes that strength that he showed could lead to hundreds and hundreds of millions of people being killed. And so the reality set in, and he said, no, I got to go a different direction here. And they were mad. They were angry at him because they assumed that he was going to be, an extension of the McCarthy days, where go after the commies, get them out of government, anybody could be a commie, they're lurking, you know, get rid of them. They thought he was going to be one of those guys.
It's a proper witch hunt, though, not the way it's kind of been dog whistleified by the Trump administration. You know, that was people actually being persecuted who did not have any affiliation.
A lot of them were. Yeah.
And it makes me wonder about the concept of greater good, which seems to be, you know, both an ideological motivating force for a lot of the more hawkish factors here. And I have to say, one of the things that I went back and rewatched after listening to the first several episodes of Who Killed JFK was A Few Good Men. And there's, you know, there's something there that reminds me, and probably a lot of our listeners too, reminds me so viscerally of that rationalization where we have characters who are saying, look, did I do something quote unquote wrong? Maybe, but I did it for the right reasons.
Right.
Do you feel that that was sort of a common mentality in the operators?
Well, sure,
in the CIA?
Sure. I mean, that is the military is there to protect us. And that's good. We want that. But the question is, how far do you go to protect us? Are you willing to commit war crimes in the case of Nazi Germany? Are you willing to do anything? And that's what the character that Jack Nicholson plays in Few Good Men. He says, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. I'm doing what you can't do. And so the question always is, how far are you willing to go in order to protect people? Are you willing to blow up the world? I mean, who wins? Nobody wins in that situation. You're not protecting anybody.
And unfortunately, as just mere mortal voters, we don't get to decide how far that line is.
No, we
have
don't.
No participation in that whatsoever.
No, but what we're hoping is that we as normal voters are electing people who have the good sense to know where that line is. And that's where we are now. I mean, we couldn't be more divided. You've got one guy who's willing to do anything. You know, Donald Trump is willing to do anything to keep power. And that means he even said it. I'm not making it up. He said it. We'll put the vermin, you know, we'll take those vermin and we'll put them in camps, and we'll make we'll get the blood, you know, the disgusting, the thing that's poisoning the American bloodstream. We'll put them in camps. He said that. I didn't make that up.
But he's also plagiarizing Adolf Hitler, too.
Like, well, yeah, because he can't make that stuff up. He's not smart enough. But I mean, and I always heard that he had Mein Kampf on his bedstand. Well, he probably had it on his bedstand. He didn't read it. I mean, I don't know how much he read. Who knows? I don't know what he does with reading.
Mein Kampf and the Bible, and he didn't read either of them.
Yeah, yeah, right. He probably held Mein Kampf. He held Mein Kampf up the wrong way, too, upside down.
Oh, jeez.
We're getting too far afield here. But the truth is, we want to elect people who know where that line is and not to cross it, because when you cross it, you're not protecting people.
You're also not electing a lot of the decision makers, to your point, directly in representative democracy. There's no average voter votes for a Supreme Court nominee. No average voter votes for the people in charge of the NSA or the CIA.
You're voting for a president who nominates Supreme Court justices, who nominates a Secretary of Defense, any of the positions. You're nominating somebody, or you're voting for somebody who has the power to nominate people who are sensible, who know where the line is. That's representative government, and that's what you want. You want somebody who's reasoned, who's intelligent, and who can make the right decisions.
Hey, let's take a quick pause here for a word from our sponsor, and then we'll return with more from Rob Reiner.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi, guys. Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
And we're back. Let's jump right into our conversation with Rob Reiner, already in progress.
Let's take it back to 1975 to the Church Committee again, because it's directly related to this. That's when the American public learned about a couple things that you might be familiar with if you're listening to this show, MK Ultra and COINTELPRO. Specifically, when it comes to assassinations, I'm thinking about COINTELPRO. If you jump 5 years after JFK's assassination and you look at Martin Luther King Jr., you look at JFK's brother.
RFK.
So it's like, again, not directly perhaps related to COINTELPRO, but it is a secret. It is a secret thing that we didn't know about that the FBI was doing to investigate people that they thought would be counter to the vision of the world that
Right. That's right. That's right. And you mentioned it's counterintelligence program. I mean, it's that's what they're doing. They're trying to root out anybody that goes against their ideology. You mentioned MK Ultra. MK Ultra was a program that was designed at the CIA, and this was during the Cold War, where there was a lot of concern about moles infiltrating our intelligence community and getting information. And we wanted to try to see if we could get our people inside the Soviet Union, inside the KGB. There was this big cat and mouse game going on, headed up by this head of counterintelligence, James Jesus Angleton, who is a brilliant guy, genius, but also paranoid beyond belief, that he thought there was a mole everywhere you looked. So this MK Ultra program was designed to try to create spies, people who would look like dissidents or whatever. And there was a program set up at a place called Nag's Head, and you'll get into this. You'll hear this in the other episodes. It was in North Carolina, where they took disaffected youths, Oswald being one of them. He was part of that program, and we have somebody on the podcast who knew Oswald in that program, who was there at Nag's Head. And what they did was they used LSD, they used all kinds of techniques of torture and things to try to get inside somebody's mind. This was like in the days of the Manchurian Candidate, that you could create this elusive illusion of somebody who was not who they appeared to to be. Now, it didn't really work. They didn't really were able to be successful. But the fact is, they were training people to be assets, assets for them that somewhere down the line they could use. And Oswald was part of that. Oswald was part of that. He also went and learned Russian. He learned Russian, and he was sent to the Soviet Union as part of an operation to see if they could infiltrate somebody into the Soviet Union. Now, it was a failure. He didn't get anything, but we know that that happened because he was stationed in Japan during when he was a Marine. He was a radar operator for the U-2 spy plane. And there was a guy who was also in military intelligence that was teamed up with Oswald on an operation to try to flip a Soviet colonel to come into the CIA. So Oswald was part of an intelligence community. We knew that. And once he went to Russia in 1959, they opened a file on Oswald, what they call a 201 file. And for 4 years, they had reams and reams of documents connecting the CIA with Oswald, and none of that came out in the Warren Commission report. The Warren Commission report said there's no connection. We don't know anything about Oswald. And there were thousands of documents that showed that they did.
That's what I was going to ask, because like, there's no acknowledgement that he was an asset or a reference to who his handlers might have been, or he was just a lone wolf. He was treated like a civilian who just went nuts and did this thing of his own volition.
Well, it's interesting. He said, I was just a patsy. I was a patsy. Now, you know, if you're accused of murder, the first thing you're saying is, I didn't do it. I don't know. I didn't do it. You're not saying I'm a patsy. A patsy is a guy who knows that something else is going on that he's being set up for. And then when you and people ask, right. well, didn't he want to, you know, he was a lone wolf and didn't he want to make a name for himself? Well, if you want to make a name for yourself, you say what you did. You don't say I'm a patsy. You say I did it because I believe right. America. You do that. It's the exact opposite.
Okay, I've read some things and I've heard some things that Oswald was potentially meeting with a group of Cuban exiles in Dallas right before the assassination. Did you find anything that may corroborate that?
No, we didn't find that he was meeting with a group of Cuban exiles. What we did find was that, again, and it's known, this is on record, that he went to New Orleans a few months in April, May. He went to New Orleans and he joined what they call the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Now, that was a legitimate organization. They had chapters around the country. But when he went to New Orleans, he started his own chapter. And he was the only member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. There was no other members. He was the only one. And he handed out leaflets. And if this is something we know because we have photographs, in one of the pictures, he's handing out leaflets and there's a CIA operative in the background of one of those photographs. Now, the other thing is when he handed out these photographs, it was done at a place where there were anti-Castro people. He was supposed to be pro-Castro. A lot of anti-Castro, and there was a big fight. They took his leaflets, they threw it up in the air. There was a scuffle, there was a melee, and it was all caught on film. I mean, and it went on the news. So who's filming this? Who's doing this? I mean, you have to make it so that you're, you know, setting up this guy that he's a pro-Castro guy. And, otherwise he's just a lone guy sitting on the corner handing out leaflets. You know, who films the guy handing out leaflets at any corner, anywhere?
No.
Nobody.
Constructs the narrative.
Somebody making a movie.
Yes.
There's a bit of there's this emphasis kind of on narrative. And even in the internal conversations, which are now public knowledge regarding the Warren Commission, we see that there is this strong drive from people who are kind of driving the commission, even though they're not official members. I believe it was J. Edgar Hoover, famous dude, who said, look, we're going to make this look like this story. And
Yeah, you had you had not only J. Edgar Hoover, but you know, we have audio tapes of Hoover talking to Johnson, saying we can't let this thing get out of hand. The House wants to investigate it, the Senate wants to investigate it, but we got to keep a lid on this thing because it's going to go crazy. So we have to control it. And then there's a very famous memo by Nicholas Katzenbach. He was the Deputy Attorney General under Robert Kennedy. And he released a memo saying we have to convince the public that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. Now, this came out 3 days or a few days right after the assassination. And they're already saying this is Oswald and we got to make the public believe this. So everything was designed to create that narrative, like you said. And we get into it in the third episode where we get into the forensics of how the narrative really starts to fall apart. It really falls apart because we get into the famous single bullet theory, and they had a big problem. I mean, people who study this stuff know it's impossible to do what this one bullet was supposed to have done. And, you know, for your listeners who don't know about it, the Warren Commission said that three shots were fired from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository building, which overlooked the presidential motorcade on Elm Street. Three shots. Initially, they said the first shot hit Kennedy and in the back. The second shot, they had a problem because they said all three shots hit. The problem they had was the first shot missed. And they found out that the first shot missed because it hit a curb and a piece of concrete flicked into a bystander's cheek and he started to bleed. So now they were left with two shots, and that two shots had to do all the damage. One of the shots we know was a shot to his head. That was the fatal head wound, the shot that killed Kennedy. Then they have one bullet left to say that a bullet went into from the sixth floor, the bullet went into the Kennedy's back,
right,
6 to 8 inches below his neck, then traveled up and came out his neck, then made a turn
to the magic hit Connolly bullet, right?
Hit Connolly in the ribs, breaks some ribs, then makes another turn, hits him in the wrist, breaks the wrist bones, then makes another turn and winds up in his thigh. That's what they had to make you believe. And the guy who came up with that was a fellow named Arlen Specter, who became a senator. At the time, he was just a lawyer who was representing the committee. And he came up with this single bullet theory, this magic bullet that did all that damage. And they said, well, that's what... And by the way, you can see that bullet. It's on file in the archives and in the Warren Commission. And it's limited as evidence number 399. And it's pristine. It looks like it didn't hit anything.
Rob, should we maybe take this as an opportunity to address the elephant in the room that seems to me it should be a larger elephant, but it seems to have also been glossed over by the media a bit. Paul Landis.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
his revelations.
Yeah. See, that's interesting you bring up Paul Landis because, again, it goes back to drips and drabs, things coming out over a time. If people, Paul Landis came out with a report about, I don't know, a couple of months ago, whatever. And we interviewed him for the podcast.
Oh, cool.
He's on Ben's there. Got it. Mm-hmm. And this guy was on the trail car. He was a Secret Service agent. He was in the trail car. He was riding on the running board behind Kennedy. When the headshot came, he talks about how brain matter and the skull matter flew in his direction. And he had a duck to get out of the way of getting hit by brain matter. And he talked about how when they got to Parkland Hospital, which is where they were going to take care of Kennedy, that when he helped Jackie Kennedy up out of the seat, there was a pool of blood on the seat where they were sitting. And he looked in the back on the top of the seat, resting there was a bullet. And it was this bullet. And he didn't know what to do because he thought, well, this is a piece of evidence. And it was, he knew the bullet had been fired because it had striation marks on it, but it was essentially pristine. There was no other damage to it. And he picked it up because he thought, it's a piece of evidence. What if somebody takes it and then he went into the hospital and didn't know what to do. And he put it on Kennedy's leg when he was being worked on. And so when you hear this and you take it in not in context, you go, well, so what? There was another bullet there. But what you have to know is that this is the bullet that Arlen Specter claimed to have gone through two people. Now, if that happened, then how did the bullet wind up in the back? What, did it bounce back after it wound it? You know what I mean? The whole thing is so crazy that unless you can put all these pieces together, you go, well, so the guy found a bullet. You know, big deal.
And what would the American public have done? This is another question we can't answer. What would the American public have done in the 60s had they known these and other discrepancies? You know, Rob, entering into this, we knew there was a lot of stuff that we wouldn't get to in our conversation, like the autopsy reports, the one that got burned. The fact that Texas Governor Connally also said, I don't think that was the same bullet that hit me.
No, he said that until the day he died. He said the bullet that hit Kennedy did not hit me. What would the public have done? I think they were worried what the public would have done, because it would have put, I mean, as it is, we have distrust in government now. The trust level in government is so low now that I think that at that time it would have, you know, just blown the lid off of any trust of the Justice Department, the intelligence community, the military. You know, they were trying to keep a lid on that so that they, you know, that trust remained in government. But my contention is you trust when you know. And if you know the truth and you're open and telling the truth, you can say, hey, we made a mistake. We did something wrong. We should not have done that. And if you do that, you gain trust. You don't lose trust. And that's what we need, the basis of all democracy. And that's why I've stuck with this for so long. I believe that the foundation of a strong democracy is that the American people trust in the institutions of government. We have to trust. And by the way, people, despots know the best way to gain power is to foment distrust. And that's what Trump's been doing. It's right out of the authoritarian playbook. You just make people distrust things, and then you say, I can fix it. I'm the only one that can fix it.
This goes to one of the, I think, the big questions, and I can't speak for everyone, but this is after listening to the show and just the caliber, the level of research and investigation that you have done here. One of my big questions is, why now? Like, why this moment in time do we get the answer for who killed JFK?
Well, I think, again, it goes back to right now we're seeing the potential end of American democracy. And if people don't think that that could happen, we're seeing it right now unfold in front of our very eyes. And what we need to do is be honest and truthful with the American public. We have a lot of things that we've done wrong in this country, you know, starting with what we did to Native Americans, then what we did to Black people who were slaves for so many hundreds of years. And we have to come to grips with all this stuff in order to make a more perfect union. The people who started this country, they weren't, they didn't know everything. They, you know, Jefferson had slaves. They had slaves. But they did provide us with a working document that could make us better, that we could keep doing what we need to do to make us better, to form a more perfect union. So we have this opportunity, and the only way we're going to forge a more perfect union is to level with people, to say, this is the truth. This is true, and this is not true. And we're living at a time where it's very, very hard to get the truth out because we're loaded with disinformation. You know, you see on TikTok, they come out with all of a sudden Bin Laden is saying something and it's amplified on TikTok. And then everybody jumps on that. And you go, no, that's not right. You don't kill people because you don't believe in their ideology, or you don't like Jews, or you don't like Muslims, or you don't like Black people, whatever. That's not making it a more perfect union. So that's why we want to do this. We want to try to keep putting us back on the right track.
You know what's funny, Rob, though? Like, my kid is 15 and just an absolute product of the internet, much more than any other generation, where it was a fully formed thing by the time they, you know, were of age and just using it from as early as they can remember. But my kid very much understands the idea of vetting information that they're presented with. You know, the idea of being the arbiter of good information, and of telling people the truth.
Hats off to your kid, man, because most kids, from what I understand, and I just was at the symposium where they talked about the dangers of AI and the geniuses who are working on AI, they don't know how to control it. They don't have the single foggiest idea of how to regulate it. And what they say is a lot of young people will look at something informationally on social media. They'll read the headline and then they'll go to the comments.
I was hoping what I'm seeing in my kid is indicative of the generation. Maybe it's not. Maybe my kid is smarter than some of their peers. But
well, I mean, like I say, hats off to your kid, because I mean, if he's really studying this and figuring and trying to figure out what's true and what's not true, then hats off to him.
Well, I was just hoping that it was maybe indicative of the generation, but your research seems to say otherwise. But who knows? You know, every individual is different. So
yeah.
Hey, guys, I just want to articulate to everybody listening and to you, Rob, why I am so excited that you are one of the minds behind this project. And it has to do with how your brain functions because of the way it's functioned in the past, simultaneously focused on the macro and the micro. And just see if I can get this out so I can ask you the question. So if you go back to the fall of 1991 and you put yourself on that bridge when you began filming A Few Good Men, if you're overseeing the creative vision of this project, so that means like having that overview feel, right? While not micromanaging, but keeping yourself focused on the micro thousands of decisions that go into getting one shot, right? But you're also a producer on that project, which means you are getting to see kind of the stuff that happens behind the scenes that allows the filming to begin even. How do you think those experiences over all of these years shape the way that you've looked at this assassination as some kind of set of machinations potentially?
You know, that's a perfect summation of how I approach things. It's exactly how I do it. You know, as a director, I do have to see the overall big picture. I have to see what that looks like. And at the same time, I know that these little specific details are what make up that big picture. So you look at it and you say, does that make sense? Does that not make sense? I'm somebody who, I love puzzles. I like to do puzzles. I like to figure out how does something work? How do those pieces fit together? I'm not just jigsaw puzzles with crosswords and Sudoku and all of those kinds of things. So I do look at things in a macro way, but then I also look to individual little fine points. And does that make sense? Does that fit? Does that piece fit into that puzzle? Or is that... and maybe it does, and maybe the puzzle goes in a different direction. A lot of times you look at something and you have a certain predisposed idea as to what something will be, but then all of a sudden the thing will tell you that it isn't that. It's something else. And then you have to be open-minded enough to go down the road of where that's leading you. And so you go down all these rabbit trails to find out what, and then eventually the puzzle comes into shape and you see what it really is. And I've been at this particular puzzle for 60 years. And it wasn't until I met a number of different people who started filling in pieces and certain things that I thought, that's not maybe true. But then when I started putting it all together with all the information that I had, I went, okay, I get this. Now, when we lay it out at the end of this podcast, I can't tell you 100% for sure that these were the four shooters and that these were the four positions we're in. I just gave something away, spoiler alert. But I can tell you the best educated guess based on all the information that's been provided. The one thing I know 100% for sure, it was a conspiracy. There's no question about that. There is no question about that. This man, Lee Harvey Oswald, did not do what they said he did. Did not happen. That I know for a fact. Other than that, exactly how it was put together, I can offer you what I think happened. And then, you know, hopefully it'll spawn more discussion.
And that, I think, is our button. That is leading us to the rest of the story. Rob, thank you so much for your time. We're not blowing smoke when we say that this truly is, at least in my opinion, a top-notch, top-caliber investigation, connecting things in a way that they have not been connected before, to the point about puzzles. And you're taking on this Herculean task, right, of unraveling an official narrative that was forced upon the American and global public for more than half a century, interrogating claims that have for so often and for so long not been given the scrutiny that they deserve. We are, as we said earlier, right there with everybody listening. We're tuning in as you answer the question, who killed JFK? And, you know, usually at the end of these conversations, we ask a question that feels kind of odd to ask a creator of your stature, but
What's my favorite color?
What's your favorite color? What are icebreakers? What is there? I guess the way to make this a little more bespoke is, sir, is there a way for people to reach out to you and your team if they, like Paul Landis, have additional information that might help assemble the puzzle?
Yeah, I mean, it came out through, it's being released through iHeartRadio, and there's a team there that can field information. Listen, by the way, I'm 76 years old, and you know, I'm the last, maybe the last generation alive that will present this, and I'm sure that there's going to be a lot more information down the road that's going to come out. Like I say, almost 5,000 documents are still being withheld. So I'm hoping that we can keep this alive long enough for all of us to find out the exact truth.
I got to add really quickly, it looks like you're the exact same age as Stephen King. This obviously loomed very large for him as well.
Yes.
11/22/63. Right. You know, we talked about comedians and satirists and science fiction and stuff. So many amazing ways that folks like that, who maybe you wouldn't immediately think, can really shed light on this stuff. I learned a lot of this stuff from that book. And a lot of it is historically accurate. Of course, it's a work of fiction. But, you know, same exact age. So no wonder this is something that has been on his mind in the same way.
Yeah,
maybe for our generation.
If you're alive,
you
never, ever, ever will forget that moment and how it affected you. It won't. It doesn't go away.
You directed Stand By Me too, didn't you? Didn't you direct Stand By Me?
Well, I did direct Stand By Me. I also directed Misery, which was a Stephen King.
Yeah, that's of course, God.
And
you're
Castle
so varied
Rock,
in your output. I forget sometimes which ones are yours.
At Castle
Rock, we did 7 Stephen King books.
Yep. And we didn't even talk about LBJ from 2016.
And
incredible.
Yeah. We also didn't talk about, so many things, the conversations LBJ had in the wake of things, Hoover, the list goes on, and we're telling you folks the best way to get these answers. Anytime you are hearing this conversation and you think, Rob and the guys didn't get to this point, we promise you, tune in to Who Killed JFK, and let's keep, to your point, Mr. Reiner, let's keep the story alive.
Every Wednesday.
You know what a time, folks. We are super excited about Who Killed JFK. It really is, as I said earlier, it really is a top-notch investigation. And my only regret is that we didn't get to everything, but I am pretty confident that Rob and Soledad are going to get to most things in this one.
Oh, yeah. The level of detail in that show is astounding. You know, it's a weird line sometimes when we do an episode like this where we're promoting, like in a way promoting a show, right? But we're just having a conversation with someone talking about these topics. But just this show, man, it's intense.
And also just to have someone who's as much of a legend as Rob is, and I think we're all fans of various facets of his work. And, you know, it's one person who you can truly say is a gentleman and a scholar and a legendary director and humanitarian and just an overall good guy. I think we were all blown away by his candor and generosity and just, wow, I'm still kind of reeling from that.
And as Rob would say, the puzzle continues. The mystery unfolds. He gave us some light spoilers. We would like to hear your thoughts, folks, on what they rightly call the greatest murder mystery in the history of the United States. Let us know. We try to be easy to find online.
That's right. You can find us at the handle Conspiracy Stuff on X, FKA Twitter, YouTube, and also on Facebook, where we have our Facebook group. Here's Where It Gets Crazy. Join in on the conversation there if you wish. On TikTok and Instagram, you can find us at the handle Conspiracy Stuff Show. But wait, there's more.
Oh, there's more. Hey, on the YouTube front, if you maybe subscribed to us a long time ago, make sure you head over there again and put alerts on, basically. Because there's going to be a ton of stuff coming there in the near future, so just keep a lookout. If you want to call us, we also have a phone number. It's 1-833-STDWYTK, and when you call in, you leave a voicemail. You get 3 minutes, give yourself a cool nickname, and say whatever you'd like. Just please let us know if we can use your name and voice on one of our listener mail episodes. And hey, if you want to send us other things, links, all kinds of good stuff, you can also send us an email.
We read every single email we get where we are, conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.